14. Early in 1930, Müller was succeeded as Chancellor by Heinrich Brüning. For the first time within memory, Germany had a strong master. From 1914 to 1923, all governments had been weak. Stresemann had ruled ably and energetically, but with a gentle hand, not hurting a soul. Brüning constantly hurt a lot of people. It was his way. He was rather proud to be unpopular. He was a hard, bony man with severe, narrowed eyes peering through rimless spectacles. Anything obliging and polished went against his nature. His successes, and he undoubtedly had some, could always be described by the catchphrase, "Operation successful, patient dead," or "Position held, ranks decimated." To prove the absurdity of reparation payments, he took them to the extreme, and thereby brought Germany's economy to the verge of collapse, causing banks to close their doors and the unemployment figures to reach 6 million. To keep the budget balanced, nevertheless, his grim, steely spirit imposed the precept of the strict paterfamilias, "Tighten your belts." In a regular sequence, new emergency decrees appeared every 6 months, each yet again reducing salaries, pensions, social benefits, and finally even private wages and rates of interest. Each was the logical consequence of the last one, and each time Brüning, clenching his teeth, imposed the painful logic. Many of Hitler's most effective instruments of torture were first introduced by Brüning, such as safeguarding foreign reserves, which made travel abroad impossible, and the Reich Flight Tax, which did the same for emigration. Even the beginnings of the restriction of the freedom of the press and the gagging of Parliament can be traced to Brüning. Yet paradoxically, his actions were rooted in the conviction that he was defending the Republic. Understandably, the Republicans began to ask themselves whether there was anything left to defend. To my knowledge, the Brüning regime was the first essay and model of a form of government that has since been copied in many European countries, the semi-dictatorship in the name and in defence of democracy against fully-fledged dictatorship. Anyone who takes the trouble to study Brüning's rule in depth will find all those factors that make this sort of government the inevitable forerunner of the very thing it is supposed to prevent, its discouragement of its own supporters, the way it undermines its own position, its acceptance of a loss of freedom, its lack of ideological weapons against enemy propaganda, the way it surrenders the initiative, and its collapse at the final moment when the issue is reduced to a simple question of power. Brüning had no real following. He was tolerated. He was the lesser evil, the strict schoolmaster who accompanied the chastisement of his pupils with the words, "This will hurt me more than you," rather than a sadistic torturer. One supported Brüning because he seemed to be the only bulwark against Hitler. Knowing that he owed his own political life to the threat posed by Hitler, Brüning had to fight against him, but at all costs refrain from destroying him. Hitler must not be allowed to come to power, but must remain a continual danger. Brüning kept up this difficult balancing act with a poker face and clenched teeth for 2 years. That was his greatest achievement. The moment would come when he would lose his balance. It could not be indefinitely postponed. What then? This question overshadowed the entire Brüning era, a period in which the gloomy present was lightened only by comparison with the prospect of a ghastly future. Brüning had nothing to offer the country but poverty, the curtailment of liberty, and the assurance that there was no alternative. At best, it was a call to austerity. His nature was too bleak even to make this call in stirring tones. He gave the country no purpose, no inspiring leadership. He only covered it in joyless shade. Meanwhile, the forces that had lain low for so long gathered noisily. On September the 14th, 1930, there were Reichstag elections. At a bound, the Nazis, hitherto a ridiculous splinter party, became the second largest faction in the House. They jumped from 12 seats to 107. From that day, the central figure of Brüning's period was no longer Brüning, but Hitler. The question was no longer whether Brüning would remain in power, but whether Hitler would come to power. The most passionate and embittered political arguments ensued, for and against not Brüning, but Hitler. In the suburbs, where the gunfights began again, it was not Brüning's supporters who shot his opponents, but Hitler's supporters who killed Hitler's enemies. Hitler himself, his past, his character, and his speeches were still rather a handicap for the movement that gathered around him. In 1930, he was still widely regarded as a somewhat embarrassing figure with a dismal past, the Munich saviour of 1923, the man of the grotesque beer cellar putsch. Besides, for ordinary, and not only clever, Germans, his personal appearance was thoroughly repellent. The pimp's forelock, the hoodlum's elegance, the Viennese suburban accent, the interminable speechifying, the epileptic behaviour with its wild gesticulations and foaming at the mouth, and the alternately shifty and staring eyes. And then there were the contents of those speeches, the delight in threats and in cruelty, the bloodthirsty execution fantasies. Most of those who began to acclaim Hitler at the Sportpalast, indoor sports stadium in Berlin, scene of many political speeches, notably by Hitler, in 1930, would probably have avoided asking him for a light if they had met him in the street. That was the strange thing. Their fascination with the boggy, dripping cesspool he represented, repulsiveness taken to extremes. No one would have been surprised if a policeman had taken him by the scruff of the neck in the middle of his first speech, and removed him to some place from which he would never have emerged again, and where he doubtless belonged. As nothing of the sort happened, and, on the contrary, the man surpassed himself, becoming ever more deranged and monstrous, and also ever more notorious, more impossible to ignore, the effect was reversed. It was then that the real mystery of the Hitler phenomenon began to show itself, the strange befuddlement and numbness of his opponents, who could not cope with his behaviour, and found themselves transfixed by the gaze of the basilisk, unable to see that it was hell personified that challenged them. Summoned as a witness before the highest German court, Hitler bellowed at the judges that he would one day come to power by strictly constitutional means, and then heads would roll. Nothing happened. The white-haired president of the Supreme Court did not think of ordering the witness to be taken into custody for contempt. In the presidential elections against Hindenburg, Hitler declared that victory was his in any case. His opponent was 85, he was 43. He could wait. Nothing happened. When he said it again at his next meeting, the audience tittered as if it had been tickled. One night, six stormtroopers fell on a dissident in his bed and literally trampled him to death, for which they were sentenced to death. Hitler sent them a telegram of praise and acknowledgement. Nothing happened. No, something did happen. The murderers were pardoned.